KALW.
During Donald Trump's campaign for president, he discussed the possibility of a registration for Muslims with a reporter from NBC.
And do you go to mosques and sign these people up into the system?
Different places. You sign them up at different, but it's all about management.
After the election, Carl Higbee, speaking for a Trump super PAC, told Megyn Kelly of Fox News that a Muslim registry would be constitutional.
I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
You're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am
saying
is that
we need
to protect
America
first.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it. And I'm not saying I agree with it. But in this case, I absolutely believe that a regional
base... You can't be citing Japanese internment camps as precedent for anything the president-elect is going to do.
Many Japanese Americans have long memories of being incarcerated 75 years ago during World War II in what were called relocation or internment camps. Last summer, KALW's Lisa Morehouse got on a bus in San Francisco's Japantown, joining a four-day pilgrimage to one of those camps, the former Tule Lake Segregation Center, just south of the California-Oregon border. She found out that agriculture was closely linked to the incarceration of Japanese Americans, and that the farm at Tule Lake Camp was essential to both their existence and their resistance.
This is the most remarkable bus ride I've ever taken. Sitting next to me are the survivors of prison camps like Tule Lake and their children and grandchildren. Buses like this one are also traveling from San Jose, Union City, Seattle, Portland. Over 450 people are converging for this pilgrimage. When we arrive at the college campus that will be our base, one of the first people I meet is Sacramento resident Richie Fua.
I wanted to see the place for the last time.
Fua's 98 years old and doesn't think he'll make this trip again, but his memories of being imprisoned at Tule Lake are crystal clear.
19949. That was my number government gave me.
He says at his age, he doesn't remember his social security number, but he remembers this.
19949. You were more a number than a name.
Camp administrators assigned Fua that number when he was 24 years old, soon after he was forced off his family's Bellingham, Washington farm.
We raised all kinds of vegetables, carrots, tomatoes, strawberry, pea.
Before the war, nearly two-thirds of West Coast Japanese Americans worked in agriculture. These farmers faced lots of discrimination, but despite that, by 1940, Japanese Americans grew almost 40% of the produce in California. Then, the Japanese military bombed Pearl Harbor.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone.
As this 1940s era film from the newly created War Relocation Authority shows, resentment and hysteria grew toward anyone of Japanese origin, even though most were American citizens.
Most were loyal, but no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores.
On February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order which authorized removing people from military areas. Japanese Americans could read between the lines. The order was primarily aimed at them. 93-year-old Jim Tanimoto's family grew peaches in the Sacramento Valley town of Gridley.
The executive order 9066 was signed. Things changed.
That is why the commanding general of the Western Defense Command determined that all Japanese within the coastal area should move inland.
Onto so-called relocation or internment camps. Many had to abandon their orchards and fields with crops ready to harvest.
Evacuation. More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states, to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places. Two-thirds of the evacuees are American citizens by right of birth. The rest are their Japanese-born parents and grandparents.
Like Jim Tanimoto's immigrant father, but the younger generation was made up of California farm kids. Jim Tanimoto even grew up hunting in the Tule Lake Basin. But when he got off the train at Tule Lake in the summer of 1942, he saw a landscape dominated by barracks covered in black tar paper.
There was rows and rows and rows of these buildings. You know, we were inside the barbed wire fence and the armed guard towers. If I cross this, I might get shot. Hey, I'm an American citizen. Now, I'm the one that's being hunted.
The War Relocation Authority put it differently.
They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people, the unwounded casualties of war.
But 15,000 Japanese Americans were forced to live here, behind barbed wire. And Tanimoto and others who were successful farm owners before the war were about to become field workers for the U.S. government.
So I first want to say I'm very honored to be able to share this tour with you today and bring you around the camp.
On the pilgrimage, those of us on a bus tour have to imagine the guard towers and those rows of barracks, long since torn down or moved. The terrain now is mostly dry, dusty land, a few dramatic rock outcroppings, and bright green, well-irrigated fields.
I know I had a question about the farming in the area, so I'll talk a little about that.
Over 1,000 Japanese American incarcerees worked the land here, most earning just a quarter of what farm workers made at the time.
But you know, potatoes, carrots, any kind of camp food that had to be stored here, that's what those main storage facilities were for, off to our right.
Agriculture was central to the development of the camps. Many of the new War Relocation Authority administrators came right from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Camp locations were often chosen for their existing government irrigation projects or agricultural potential. The government's intention was to improve ag land for use after the war. On the pilgrimage, I talk with people who were imprisoned here, who remember the food grown in the fields and served for dinner.
Winter crops is what you grew, cabbage, rutabagas.
Rutabagas? I don't think anybody liked them. Turnips, white long radishes for one thing.
Daikon?
Daikon, yeah.
Camp had a hog farm and the chicken farms, so we raised all the barleys and oats.
The goal was to have the camp grow and raise as much of its food as possible. When Tule Lake opened, eligible men who refused to work were threatened with crippling fines. All 10 incarceration camps had working ag programs, but Tule Lake's was different. Despite the dust, snow, and wind, and a short growing season, the farm was on former lake bed. The rich soil and the expertise of the Japanese American workers produced nearly 30 vegetable crops, plus hogs and chickens, enough to supply mess halls at Tule Lake and other camps.
You know, they knew how to grow things.
Before the war, Lucille Hitomi's father ran a commercial flower business in Mountain View. At Tule Lake, he worked the fields under white supervisors.
I remember my dad saying, I don't know if they were good farmers.
But those bosses relied on the expertise of the Japanese American laborers to develop a productive farm. To keep some semblance of normalcy, families like Hitomi's tried to create special meals. It helped that her brother worked at the camp slaughterhouse.
I don't know if this was legal, but sometimes he would bring bits of meat home. And my mother had, she brought to camp a hot plate and a frying pan. And then she'd cook the meat in the cabin, barrack. I guess it was more like home.
The stated purpose of these farms was to feed incarcerees, but camp administrators took produce, grain, and hay grown by these imprisoned Japanese American workers and sold it on the open market, over 2 million tons of it from Tule Lake alone. At the pilgrimage, all the participants pack into a college auditorium, including a handful of people in their 90s. Writer and historian Barbara Takei tells the crowd they're all discovering the story of Japanese-American descent. That's because 1 year after ordering Japanese-Americans out of their homes, the government made every adult in every camp fill out a questionnaire. When I sit down with Barbara Takei, she explains.
This outrageous questionnaire was used to separate the so-called loyal from the disloyal.
Jim Tanimoto remembers two questions caused the most confusion and anger. Number 27 asked a person's willingness to join the armed forces.
28 was the one that was really, it was sort of a trick question. Would you cut your ties with Japan and the emperor?
If he answered yes, the only acceptable response for the U.S. government, it could mean that he had ties with Japan and its emperor.
Well, I'm an American citizen and a Gridley farm boy. I have no ties with Japan or the emperor. So how was I to answer this question?
Tanimoto and all of the other young men in Block 42, his area of Tule Lake, refused to answer and got arrested and jailed in nearby towns.
I stood on my constitutional right. You can't do this to an American citizen.
The loyalty questionnaire radically changed the population and culture of Tule Lake. Adults from any of the 10 incarceration camps who didn't say yes to both questions, so-called no-nos, were labeled disloyal and sent to Tule Lake, where additional fences and guard towers went up. This was in the 1940s, two decades before the Civil Rights Movement. Here's Barbara Takei.
Post-Civil Rights Movement, we realize that the right to protest is a precious American right. It was something that people who were imprisoned in Tule Lake exercised. And because of that, they were punished.
By 1943, Tule Lake became the largest population center in California, north of Sacramento, ballooning to nearly 19,000 people, most of them labeled troublemakers. Camp got tense. With a larger workforce, the administrators expanded the farm and expected a huge harvest. But Japanese-American camp laborers complained of poor food rations and major safety concerns. Then, a truck accident on the farm injured nearly 30 laborers and killed one. Jim Tanimoto and Barbara Takei explain what happened next.
And the farm workers said, "We're not going to work no more."
They recognized that they had leverage by having the strike right when the crops are ready to pick. So the director brought in other Japanese Americans from other camps.
Strikebreakers, they came to harvest the crop.
The strikebreakers were also paid $1 an hour. So in 2 days, they could make more than a farm worker at Tule Lake would make in a month.
Camp administrators would not let the fields go unharvested. A few days later, the Tule Lake laborers had more to be angry about.
Workers saw a truck leaving the warehouse area filled with food.
Ostensibly to feed the strikebreakers, 200 people surrounded the truck.
And that's what caused the camp director to call in a battalion. With the tanks rolling in and the camp was shut down.
Japanese-American leaders were thrown in a stockade with no legal recourse. Within days,
martial law was declared.
This marked the end of large-scale farming and the beginning of two tumultuous years at Tule Lake. The military raided barracks and hundreds of people ended up in the stockade for months. There were more protests. A radical faction grew in camp. Eventually, thousands of Japanese Americans imprisoned at Tule Lake renounced their U.S. citizenship in a chaotic and confusing time. Reversing these renunciations took nearly 20 years. The Tule Lake Segregation Center closed in the spring of 1946. 6 months after the war ended, what remained were empty barracks that once housed families and thousands of acres of rich farmland. 98-year-old Richie Fua remembers that the land he and other Japanese Americans improved was parceled off to veterans returning from war.
So when the soldiers came back and they wanted a farm where they could homestead that place.
Was that not offered to you?
No.
Some former incarcerees returned home and eventually rebuilt successful farm businesses. Not Richie Fua. His family's farm was overgrown, all the equipment stolen.
There's no way to express that feeling that when you see the place like that.
He soon left farming forever. By 1960, the number of Japanese-American farmers dropped to a quarter of their pre-war presence. With lost farms, homes, and businesses, it's estimated that wartime incarceration cost Japanese-Americans up to $4 billion in today's values. The non-economic losses to Japanese-Americans, to California, to the whole country, are impossible to measure. Barbara Takei says, especially now, we must remember
how easily people, because of fear and anger, lose sight of our important national values of justice and rule of law.
Which she says we're seeing today with Muslim Americans, refugees, and immigrants.
As though demonizing other people is going to solve our problems.
All we have to do, she says, is look at World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans to see that's not true. At the former Tule Lake Segregation Center, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That piece was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization. Meredith Hodnott helped with research.